Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my pleasure to introduce Christopher Agee, Assistant Professor of in the History Department at the University of Colorado, Denver, and also the author of The Streets of San Francisco, a really interesting look at how the policing and the police department and how to police a large city developed in reaction to the unusual events of the 50s and the 60s. So, Chris Agee.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming tonight. All right, well, so I've written this book, and I'll spend the next 40 minutes or so talking about it, and then we'll have a little time for Q&A. So our histories of the 1960s burst with images of large, cacophonous showdowns between citizens and police. Policing scenes such as these, from the freedom movement in Birmingham, the black uprising in Detroit, the anti-war demonstrations in Chicago, the Chicano Moratorium in Los Angeles, and the Stonewall Rebellion in New York dominate our sense of the 60s. And San Francisco itself figures prominently in these narratives. In 1960, police rioted against anti-HUAC demonstrators within the rotunda of City Hall, and some scholars have since pointed to that San Francisco clash as the moment the 60s began. At the time, the new left labeled the police pigs of the state, and the new right championed the police as the thin blue line. But activists on both sides agreed that the police were a reliable arm of government elites. Historians looking back at the 1960s have adopted that perspective. Our stories of the 60s often assume that police obediently served the interests of law and order politicians like Governor Ronald Reagan and President Richard Nixon. I began uncovering a different story about 10 years ago when I started investigating the history of San Francisco in the 1950s and 60s. In my research, I took a different approach from many earlier studies by interviewing police officers themselves. These police and the dozens of other community members I interviewed recalled the famous riots and crackdowns that have received so much attention. But they also emphasized the day-to-day law enforcement that took place between those more spectacular moments. My interviewees explained that on most days, police took to the streets with little guidance from City Hall or the Hall of Justice. John Minderman made this point when he described to me his experience as a rookie patrol officer walking a beat in San Francisco's Polk Gulch neighborhood. On one particular evening, he encountered his first gay bar, the Cable Car Village. Minderman recalled for me, "I walk into the Cable Car Village on the north side of California, above Hyde there, and I stopped as I go inside the front door. And I'm shocked because I see nothing but men down the bar. And in the back, there's a jukebox. And there's, I guess, a small dance floor because I never quite got back that way. It's maybe 40 feet. And I see men dancing with each other back there. And I stopped. I've never seen anything like this. I was 22 years. I've been going on the streetcar to San Francisco State and living at home. I look in there and I go, what? Could this be in the parlance of the SFPD, could this be a fruit joint? Well, maybe it is. And everything stops when they see me. Everybody's apprehensive. They've never seen this guy before, you know? I look in and I go, I better not do anything because there's so many of them and there's just me and I have no radio. But I think it's a fruit joint, so I back out and I go about my diligent business. Well, through my interviews with Minderman and others, I was discovering that police in mid-20th century America maintained a great deal of autonomous discretion. Police officers didn't simply walk the streets covering out the proclaimed policies of city elites. Instead, they spent much of their time devising their own standards and procedures. John Minderman later elaborated, "To be regarded as an effective police officer in the SFPD, the bottom line criteria was that you had to be able to handle anything that came up, okay? That was it. If you had to call for help, if you had to call for assistance, if you couldn't figure it out, what? Why did we hire you? We hired you specifically because we're going to send you into situations, and you have to do what's right. So don't call us." Well, during the 1950s and 60s, rank-and-file police like Minderman experienced a strange mix of power and powerlessness. In San Francisco's political sphere, rank-and-file police were voiceless. The police chief spoke for the SFPD, and the rank-and-file's Police Officers Association limited itself to social activities and pension services. The POA was so politically irrelevant that on one occasion, the city's police commissioners failed to even recognize the association's president. San Francisco's rank-and-file officers also lacked power within the police department. Upper-rank officers could bully and exploit lower-ranking police with relative impunity. As Sergeant Jerry Crowley bluntly summarized, your sergeant, your lieutenant, your captain could shit on you till the cows came home. But out on the streets, patrol officers enjoyed tremendous autonomous discretion. Discretionary power was a defining feature of mid-20th century law enforcement, and it was the norm across post-war San Francisco. In 1940s Chinatown, for instance, officers assigned to the SFPD's Chinatown detail operated with almost total independence from the Hall of Justice. The Chinatown detail officers distinguished themselves from other police by forgoing regular uniforms. Instead, they wore flashy Wilkes Bashford-style suits that made them look like movie detectives. The Chinatown detail operated out of a secret hideout with a single phone line. Frequently, no one was staffing the desk with that phone. Lacking any outside supervision, members of the Chinatown detail created their own policing arrangements. For instance, when Chinatown residents wanted to contact the police, they did so by either leaving a message for the Chinatown detail at Red's Bar in Beckett Alley, or standing at the intersection of Washington and Grant Streets and waiting for the patrol to pass by. Some Chinatown police used their discretion to oversee illegal gambling and to collect payoffs for the political machine running San Francisco's City Hall. In 1950, one informant claimed that officers extorted $35,000 a month from Chinatown gamblers, and another claimed that Inspector George Patty Wafer spent so much time inside a Chinatown gambling house that other customers mistook the detective for the establishment's owner. Well, as my research helped me understand the street-level autonomy of post-war police, I also began seeing how the issue of police discretion emerged as a major concern for post-war liberals. While New Left activists demanded less policing and the New Right called for unleashed law enforcement, liberals spent the 1950s and 60s insisting that they could reform police discretion to produce fair policing. Our stories of law and order politics often describe liberals on the defensive, but San Francisco's history tells us a different lesson. As policymakers grappled with the challenge of discretion, a new generation of what I call cosmopolitan liberals took a vanguard role in building our present-day police departments and defining our modern-day understandings of crime and freedom. Well, my book opens during the late 1940s at a moment of alarm for the city's downtown business elites. City elites had traditionally regarded San Francisco as a city of family men. It was a city, in other words, where a white man could find a breadwinning job with which to support a family. Elites assumed that all responsible citizens were heterosexual, colorblind, and committed to traditional gender roles. But at the conclusion of World War II, manufacturing jobs and young white families began streaming out of San Francisco, heading for the suburbs in the South Bay and beyond. At the same time, African Americans were pouring into the city. During the 1940s, San Francisco's black population skyrocketed by more than 900%. Business leaders in San Francisco's downtown fretted over the city's social stability and economic vitality, and groups like the Chamber of Commerce quickly drew up new plans to remake San Francisco. Downtown elites proposed jettisoning San Francisco's old blue-collar manufacturing sector. Elites aimed instead to remake San Francisco by redeveloping the city's downtown with tall office towers and apartment buildings. But as business elites tried to realize this vision, they ran into San Francisco's old political machine. Under Mayor Elmer Robinson and his administration, corrupt machine officials proved more interested in collecting police payola than in pursuing redevelopment. The redevelopment schemes of downtown officials floundered in what one observer called a web of venality and obstruction. Business leaders needed a reformer willing to take on the machine, professionalize city government, and promote their redevelopment agenda. They found their banner holder in George Christopher. Christopher was the son of Greek immigrants, the product of the working class South of Market neighborhood. As a young adult, Christopher had played minor league baseball and then amassed a small fortune in the milk industry. In 1955, this so-called wavy-haired dairyman ran for mayor, and his campaign promised to serve the city's family men through reformed government. Christopher vowed to wipe out corruption and centralize policymaking power into the hands of nonpartisan experts. San Franciscans embraced this message, and Christopher won the election by the greatest margin of victory in San Francisco history. Mayor Christopher filled his police commission with a corporate lawyer and two former presidents of the Chamber of Commerce, and he eventually tapped Thomas Cahill, police chief. Cahill promised that his officers would no longer serve as bagmen for the machine, but would instead encourage downtown growth by warring on crime. Under Cahill, the SFPD earned a national reputation for its professionalism. Television shows ranging from The Lineup during the 1950s to The Streets of San Francisco two decades later celebrated the SFPD for its technical proficiency, academic expertise, and tough-fisted policing. But just as Christopher and Cahill were settling into power and promising to boost the economy through top-down law enforcement, the nation's criminologists began recognizing an aspect of policing that they had not previously noticed. During the mid-1950s, researchers observed police officers in their day-to-day duties, and they began realizing that patrolmen were creating their own procedures and policies in nearly every phase of their work. In one study, for instance, researchers watched as police officers interrogated suspects with a fake polygraph machine that the officers had fashioned from a kitchen colander. When Mayor Christopher and Chief Cahill were confronted with the discovery of discretion, they expressed little concern. Christopher and Cahill assumed that patrol officers were responsible family men, and they could therefore trust police to use their discretion to defend family values. The mayor and chief particularly valued police discretion when officers patrolled areas like North Beach's beat scene. San Francisco leaders regarded the beats as a clear threat to the city's morals. The beats rejected patriotism, consumerism, white-collar work, and traditional gender roles. Here we have a derisive image of a beat family from Life magazine illustrating how the beats violated traditional values. I'm not sure how well you can see this. All the aspects of the room are numbered and captioned, and here this last one, number 22, reads, "Beat baby who has gone to sleep on the floor after playing with beer cans." Well, in North Beach, police officers used their discretion to maintain traditional moral standards. For instance, in 1957, police officers used their discretion to determine that Allen Ginsberg's Howl and Other Poems was, quote, obscene and unfit for children to read. And when Lawrence Ferlinghetti's City Lights Bookshop continued selling the book of poetry, police raided the shop and arrested both Ferlinghetti and his sales clerk, Shig Moreau. Then, in subsequent years, a young patrolman named Bill Bigorani used his discretion to defend traditional morals in the neighborhood. Bigorani took to North Beach each day with identity cards he himself had designed, and then compelled Bohemians to fill out these cards so that he could compile his own private Rolodex of North Beach denizens. In his search for drugs, Bigorani entered beat apartments and sometimes subjected Bohemians to on-the-spot physical examinations so that he could search for needle marks. Bigorani also used his broad powers to arrest beats when those Bohemians were engaged in activities not specifically prescribed by law. Bigorani, for instance, jailed a young woman for walking on the sidewalk without wearing shoes, and in another instance, he detained a man for wearing a beard and being unemployed. Here is a, if you can see it there, there's a beat response to Bigorani, and I put him up in Evachi. This is Grant and Green Streets. Well, Chief Cahill defended this sort of law enforcement. The police chief asked, "Anyway, what do you mean by crime? Don't you consider leading juveniles into a life like that a crime? That's the greatest crime you can commit." Cahill warned that beats believed that, quote, anything went as far as sex was concerned, and that they exposed children to, quote, sacrilegious quotations. "The way they talked about Christ," he exclaimed. Cahill concluded that patrol officers like Bigorani had a responsibility, quote, "to protect our young people from that." Well, Christopher and Cahill also supported the rank and file when officers used their discretion against San Francisco's gay bars. Some officers chose to harass gay bars by taking photos of patrons, and others would call in bomb scares. When police wanted to revoke a gay bar's license, they relied on broad, lewd vagrancy charges. These vague codes criminalized morals violations and allowed individual officers to define those morals violations. Charlotte Coleman, the owner of a gay and lesbian bar, the Golden Cask, described how officers used morals codes to build up a case against her establishment. "I had an anniversary party, and one guy came in. It was a little bit of a costume party. It was a lot of funny costumes. It wasn't really drag. And one guy was seen to wear slippers, silver slippers. That was a morals charge. And I had a funny bartender from he was from New Orleans, a funny little guy. Somebody had given me a great big bottle of Taboo perfume, which I couldn't stand, and I left it at the bar. And he'd take a little dab, and he'd go behind the ears of customers like that, just for kicks. He was sort of a kicky guy. That was a morals charge." So they had about 50 things like that. They never got the names of anybody. You couldn't call these people in. They were just frames, descriptions. Well, on other occasions, officers used their discretion to harass gay bars in ways that enriched themselves. In other words, some officers used their discretion to continue demanding payola. Bob Ross, a former bartender at the downtown 5A5 Club, described a shakedown he received from a lieutenant during the 1950s. The officer, Ross later recounted, strode into the bar and asked, "Hi, Bob, are you the manager?" And I'd say, "Why, yes." "Hi, I'm Lieutenant so-and-so." "You don't say Lieutenant so-and-so." "Yes, the San Francisco Police Department." And right away you'd go, "Oh, shit, you know, what are we up to now?" And the first time he came in, he was soliciting for the Police Athletic League. And I said, "Oh, I just sent them $25 or something." And he said, "Oh." He said, "This is actually the police officer's retirement league section of the Police Athletic League." I said, "I never heard of that." He said, "You will, let me assure you." And I said, "What do you need, $100? He says, "No, it's going to be $500 a month." And he says, "The captain will be by here to collect it next Tuesday at 7:30. That's how brazen they were. The captain walked in at 7:30 to collect his money. Well, in moments like these, police officers were using their discretion in ways that appeared to interfere with the city's downtown growth agenda. And these moments therefore opened room for a liberal challenge. Christopher assumed that his redevelopment of the downtown would attract professionals who, like himself, defined crime around traditional family morals. But his redevelopment strategy had an unexpected outcome. The tall office towers he was building were attracting thousands of young white professionals who were single and without kids. These young adults proved less interested in protecting the morals of children and more interested in creating a safe but exciting city. These young professionals began questioning whether police were in fact serving the common good with their discretion. San Francisco's young white-collar liberals often denigrated North Beach Beats as, quote, "the motorcycle crowd without motorcycles, little children from the country, juvenile delinquents a little bit grown up." Now, these quotes were hardly complimentary, but they also revealed that liberals regarded Beats as more of a joke than a criminal danger. The liberals argued that the SFPD should only police activities that caused physical or material harm. While white-collar liberals often questioned the Bohemians' morals, they didn't see the Beats as a violent threat to others. Liberals argued if the city took away the police's discretion over morals, the SFPD could redirect its efforts towards, quote, muggings, cutthroat hoods, and crimes of violence. Liberals also argued that reducing police discretion and redefining crime would spur the downtown's economic growth. San Francisco's young liberals celebrated the droves of sightseers now streaming to see the Beats in North Beach. And they commented that the Beats, gay bars, and artistic license gave their city a, quote, prestige, a New York atmosphere, and a reputation as a center for culture and enlightenment. Indeed, male white-collar workers consumed sexually explicit art and entertainment themselves. This point was illustrated in 1964 after San Francisco police busted the Vorpal Gallery for displaying a series of statuettes by Ron Boise. Inspired by the Kama Sutra, Boise's 18-inch figurines were crafted from the metal of old car fenders. They were gaunt, twisted, and offered depictions of sexuality that were both explicit and confusing. And so here they are preparing them for the trial, putting them under paper bags. Well, when the case went to trial, the liberal defense attorneys turned to the city's downtown professionals for support. The defense called to the stand Michael Phillips, a young Bank of America employee. The Chronicle noted his, quote, button-down collar and his rep tie, and described him as, quote, the model of the young executive. Well, Phillips told the court that he owned three of Boise's statuettes, and that since the Vorpal Gallery bust, 70 people had come to his Coal Valley home to see these, quote, beautiful works. With the message that cultural and sexual pluralism was both harmless and economically productive, liberals began supporting bohemians, gays and lesbians, and artists in their fights to curb police discretion. San Francisco liberals were at the forefront in reinterpreting the nation's obscenity laws. Beginning with the Howell case, San Francisco ACLU lawyers trailblazed the argument that police could not use their discretion to declare a work obscene if that work had, quote, social value to other artists and scholars. San Francisco liberals led the charge in eliminating California's broad vagrancy codes. And in 1960, they professionalized the policing of gay bars by supporting a group of gay bar owners who exposed police officers for extorting payola from their establishments. Well, young white-collar workers defended bohemians, artists, and gays and lesbians as harmless, but these liberal defenses carried an important caveat. When young liberals portrayed these various groups as unthreatening, they consistently depicted these groups as white. For instance, the mainstream press never addressed the fact that in North Beach, police were directing most of their anti-Beat animus against African-American bohemians. A frequent lawyer for the North Beach Beats explained, "There is no question that the police department in the city and county of San Francisco is actively deterring integration in North Beach. They, particularly through Officer Bigrani, make it a policy to interrogate any mixed situation." In particular, police jailed this poet, Bob Kaufman, with enough regularity that several North Beach bars collected weekly donations for the poet's bail bond. Kaufman's friends often recalled the violence of these arrests. One North Beach bookstore owner later explained that the stories of Kaufman's beatings on Grant Avenue and within the Hall of Justice's elevator circulated as a, quote, sick joke on the beach. But while white liberals in the media frequently drew attention to the policing of white beats, they avoided mentioning any racial violence. Indeed, in the 3 years of violent confrontations between Kaufman and patrol officers, the downtown press never covered a single one of the black poet's arrests. White liberals resisted including blacks in their defenses of cultural pluralism, in part because white officials often feared that many black migrants were violently race conscious. In his discussions of civil rights, city leaders like Mayor Christopher and Chief Cahill often began by insisting that San Francisco was a colorblind city. Government officials, they claimed, simply didn't see race. In 1949, San Francisco's police chief explained that the SFPD, quote, did not recognize minority groups as such. Rather than seeing skin color, the police, quote, recognize only two groups of persons in the process of its functions, those who are lawless and those who are law-abiding. Now, black spokespersons, by contrast, insisted that many patrol officers were, in fact, quite race conscious in their treatment of African Americans. Civil rights activists charged that many rank-and-file police officers were either ignoring their communities or subjecting black people to physical brutality. Commenting on this schizophrenic style of law enforcement, one black Hunters Point resident complained, "The police department in this neighborhood is lousy. A policeman is never seen until he's called, and then it seems like the whole force comes out with paddy wagons and police dogs." Well, when black people can accuse police officers of bigoted law enforcement, city officials retorted that these protesters were creating new racial divisions in San Francisco's otherwise colorblind character. For instance, in the 1950s, black adult men protested that some police officers were referring to them as, quote, boy. Police Chief Cahill dismissed these complaints by referring to his relationship with his own children. Apparently oblivious to the paternalism in his own remarks, Cahill related, "I have three sons of my own, and there are many times that I will say, listen, boy, go to bed. Listen, boy, shut off that television. And I don't feel that I'm hurting him in any way or reducing him to any lower standard of citizen." Cahill admonished San Francisco's southern-born black migrants, "Don't carry the things that bother you in another area into San Francisco with you, but accept the life that we have here in San Francisco, which I think is very good." Well, San Francisco elites repeatedly emphasized that many of San Francisco's new black migrants had grown up in the Jim Crow South. White officials assumed that the racist Southern society had taught these black migrants to view whites as legitimate targets for crime. Describing San Francisco's black migrants, one social worker claimed, "Cheating is no crime among many of these people. That's a hangover from the South, where in the white man's home, you took whatever you could get away with." White San Francisco policymakers worried that the city's black migrants were passing their anti-white hostility on to the next generation of youth. As one liberal explained, the average black man arrived in San Francisco, quote, got a tenement room, a common law wife and a bottle, and settled down to pass his defeat onto his children. As a result, the Examiner warned, black children in Hunters Point, as young as 8 or 9, had already learned from their elders to, quote, face the white stranger with eyes of suspicion, distrust, or hate. With these fears, white liberals often stopped short of calling for reduced police discretion over black San Franciscans. In order to produce fairer law enforcement, San Francisco's black residents had to develop their own community-based solutions. So when police used their discretion to disregard youth violence in black neighborhoods, some residents began taking to the streets themselves and negotiating truces between warring gangs. In San Francisco, this effort was spearheaded by Orville Luster, the director of a San Francisco youth group called Youth for Service. During the 1960s, Youth for Service sent street workers all across the city to help young people find peaceful resolutions to their conflicts. Here he is meeting with gang leaders. Walter Turner, a former Hunters Point gang member, remembered the empathy and courage of Youth for Service street workers. "We would sit back and we'd be looking at them coming in and we'd be saying, they are so out of place. What are they doing? But, you know, it was like they wasn't from these projects like we were. But, you know, they would still be there and they wasn't afraid. And that's what we had to respect them for, because you couldn't find a lot of people who'd come into a situation like that. But when somebody would, you'd have to respect it, because it would be like, why are they here when they don't have to be? They could be somewhere else, far away from here. But they were there trying to help." Well, city officials fretted that black race consciousness would lead to violence. But Orville Luster and Youth for Service believed that they could channel race consciousness towards pride and peacekeeping. Orville Luster illustrated that potential during the 1966 Hunters Point race riot. In September of that year, a white Hunters Point police officer shot a black youth in the back. Blacks expelled whites from the neighborhood, took to the streets, and battled with police. But when the dust cleared, Hunters Point emerged with little permanent damage. Liberals credited Orville Luster and his street workers for this lack of destruction. One Chronicle reporter proclaimed, "Again and again, the name of Orville Luster was mentioned in the significant path he and some 100 youths from his organization had played in keeping violence to a minimum." Indeed, Street workers had gone out into the neighborhood with megaphones and had convinced many young people to save their own community. A Liberal Chronicle reporter applauded, "The difference between San Francisco and Watts was that there were fingers in the ghetto, Negro leaders people trusted, who cautioned against lawlessness, against rioting." Liberals, both in San Francisco and Washington, D.C., began cutting checks for Youth for Service and accepting Youth for Service's race-conscious voice in politics. But Luster found that in order to maintain white liberal funding for neighborhoods like Hunter's Point, he needed to continue insisting upon the importance of community peacekeeping. And that message required Luster to continue stirring white fears. In the late 60s, Tom Wolfe observed Orville Luster's approach to fundraising, and he called the strategy Luster resorted to Mau-Mauing. Wolfe described Luster in action. "There was one genius in the art of confrontation who had Mau-Mauing down to what you could term a laboratory science. He had it figured out so he didn't even have to bring his boys downtown in person. He would just show up with a crock-a sack full of revolvers, ice picks, fish knives, switchblades, hatchets, blackjacks, gravity knives, straight razors, hand grenades, blowguns, bazookas, Molotov cocktails, tank rippers, unbelievable stuff. And he'd dump it all out on somebody's shiny walnut table. He'd say, 'These are some of the things I took off my boys last night. I don't know, man. 30 minutes ago, I talked a panther out of busting a cop.' And they would lay money on this man's ghetto youth patrol like it was now or never." Well, the post-war debates over police discretion were producing a cosmopolitan liberal realignment. This new cosmopolitan liberal politics was anchored by young white-collar workers, and it accepted the perspectives of bohemians, gays and lesbians, and African Americans. The coalition gathered strength through the 60s, and in 1967, Joseph Alioto rode the cosmopolitan liberal message to victory in San Francisco's mayoral race. Rather than imagining a citizenry of family men, Alioto conceived of an electorate of individuals, speaking in a language evocative to young white-collar workers. Alioto characterized the city as a place of, quote, abrasive anonymity, where, quote, the individual stands exposed to so many crosswinds of uncertainty, unshielded by the compactness and closeness of the big family or the small town. Alioto celebrated that this environment fostered pluralism and thus made cities, quote, the frontier of this greater democracy. Regarding pluralism as harmless, Alioto called on the city to define crime around violence rather than morals. San Francisco, he urged, should be, quote, at least as avant-garde on the question of what crime really is as we are reputed to be in the area of personal behavior. Alioto insisted, quote, what criminals do to decent people is the relevant consideration. The mayor then promised that an acceptance of cultural and sexual pluralism would free police to combat, quote, the real crime in the streets. Alioto set out to handle this real crime in the streets by building an alliance with black street workers who had worked with Youth for Service. Alioto accepted their race-conscious perspectives so long as they channeled their race pride into peacekeeping. Alioto earned national attention for this approach in April of 1968, following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Race rebellions erupted in over 100 other cities, but Alioto's young black allies took to the streets and helped keep San Francisco cool. Once peace was assured, Alioto invited the young black men to stand alongside him during a memorial rally at the steps of City Hall. Well, the rise of cosmopolitan liberals like Alioto confronted police officers with a potential crisis. On the one hand, cosmopolitan liberals were curbing the rank and file's autonomous discretion over morals. On the other hand, cosmopolitan liberals were extending a political voice to African Americans, gays and lesbians, and others at a time when rank and file police remained politically voiceless. In many other cities, police reacted to this liberal challenge with a turn to right-wing politics. The SFPD's rank and file did, in fact, maintain a right-wing subculture. In 1970, rank and file officers began organizing their own private variety shows. The, quote, slapstick comedy routines they performed at these gatherings included skits featuring male officers in drag, a black officer with tribal African tribal costume and a large bone scepter, and a patrolman and two patrolmen acting out the misadventures of the Fag One patrol car. But a new group of officers calling themselves the Bluecoats steered the growing rank-and-file assertiveness in a different direction. The Bluecoats argued that the San Francisco Police Officers Association should now begin speaking for police officers in the civic sphere. While not all Bluecoats shared the liberals' understanding of citizenship, they realized that by working with liberals, they could defend their own political and workplace interests. As Bluecoats watched for an opportunity, the Cosmopolitan... Bluecoats then watched for an opportunity to do this, the cosmopolitan liberals began to fracture. Two liberal factions arose. Each side justified its position by emphasizing its own relationship with the police. On the one hand, on the one side, you had Alioto. He was advocating centralized democracy. He thought the city could best promote the economy and reduce violence by channeling all the city's diverse voices into City Hall. He then characterized those who refused to join these negotiations as dangers to the city's growth and the peace. Alioto illustrated this democratic vision through the SFPD's new tax squad. The tax squad dressed its officers in masked helmets and all-black coveralls and schooled the men in judo, wrestling, karate, baton use, anti-sniper control, and house-to-house combat. Neither Alioto nor the Hall of Justice made any attempt to downplay the tax squad's physical capabilities. Department leaders described its members as, quote, outstanding physical specimens. And one squad sergeant summarized, we don't want little guys. Alioto then directed the tax squad against those groups who refused to work with City Hall. In 1969, for instance, student demonstrators at San Francisco State went on strike with a series of non-negotiable demands. And Alioto deployed the tax squad against these students until the demonstrators agreed to negotiate. Well, now, while Alioto was proposing a centralized democracy, there were cosmopolitan liberals in neighborhoods like Haight-Ashbury that insisted that democracy be decentralized. In the Haight, white and African-American liberals both championed a localist democracy, one that empowered residents to work together to, quote, lift themselves by their own bootstraps. Localist liberals, so here's a picture of the Haight in 1967, localist liberals pointed to their personal relationships with foot patrolmen as a model for their sort of authentic governance. Localists did not think that patrol officers should enjoy autonomous discretion, but they believed that if individual patrolmen used their discretion cooperatively, the officers could, quote, help people live peaceably together. Alioto's vision of centralized policing and the Haight-Ashbury's vision of cooperative discretion crashed into each other during the late 60s when thousands of hippies streamed into the Haight. Alioto believed that drugs made hippies, quote, mindless. And in this state, he warned, hippies became incapable of reasoned negotiations and were instead easy targets for, quote, hoodlums who would transform the drug users into, quote, stormtroopers dedicated to violence. Haight-Ashbury liberals, by contrast, insisted that they could always negotiate with hippies and emphasized that patrol officers could help them, quote, work together to make a truly fine model community. The neighborhood activists warned that Alioto's tax squad would only, quote, divide a community that had made great efforts to integrate its diverse populations. Well, on a late Sunday afternoon in February 1968, these two policing visions came to a head. Residents milling around on the sidewalk or peering out their windows along Haight Street watched in astonishment as phalanxes of tax squad officers marched into view. Their faces concealed by gas masks, officers began attacking hippies with mace and, for the first time since the waterfront strikes of the 1930s, tear gas. Tax squad officers then turned their attention on liberal residents, firing blanks at people watching from their windows and launching tear gas canisters at the Haight Street Free Medical Clinic. After the gas lifted, Alioto insisted that the tax squad had defended the Haight-Ashbury from a, quote, commercial element of outsiders who had introduced drugs into the neighborhood. Haight-Ashbury liberals fumed that the tax squad had in fact assaulted longtime residents who, quote, could not possibly be mistaken for hippies, The localists called on the city to replace the tax squad with foot patrolmen whose cooperation within the neighborhood would enable them, quote, to distinguish between residents and transients and to identify the suppliers and dealers of drugs in the area. Well, as both Al Yodo and the Haight-Ashbury localists emphasized their relationships with the police, the Bluecoats recognized that they could begin exploiting these rifts to advance their own interests. In 1971, Al Yodo was up for re-election and looking to advertise his ability to be both inclusive and tough on crime. Bluecoats took over the POA and assured liberals that they now supported Al Yodo's new inclusive politics. A Bluecoat founder told the media, "We're not interested in colors, only equal opportunity within the department, no matter what a man's complexion, race, or religion may be." They then insisted that their right to, quote, express themselves and extended Al Yodo a re-election endorsement. The mayor saw an opportunity to promote pluralism and the power of his office, and he therefore accepted the POA's offer. Mike Hebel, a young Bluecoat organizer, recalled the momentous endorsement meeting. The second time Al Yodo was up for election, the POA was endorsing, and I can recall them being out in an endorsement meeting where suddenly, for the first time I'd ever seen it before, the top police command and most of the brass and a lot of the captains show up. And they show up specifically to make sure that Al Yodo gets the endorsement. First time I'd ever seen them there, last time I'd ever seen them there. But it was clear to me that this was the defining moment, the shift in power, the shift in political power was moving from the chief to the association. Tom Cahill was there for 16 years, and he was the spokesperson. If you wanted to, the spokespersons for police officers in the department, you got it from Tom Cahill. That stopped. If you wanted the voice of police officers, that election defined when you no longer went to the police chief, you went to the POA. Well, Al Yodo won election, and then weeks into his new term, he attempted to further consolidate his power over the SFPD by closing two district police stations. Al Yodo's plan was to replace foot patrolmen with a patrol car-oriented 911 approach. The Haight-Ashbury liberals immediately protested the idea, insisting you can't talk to a cruising police car, and charged that Al Yodo's centralization of the police would naturally result in, quote, dehumanized and militarized force. They demanded cooperative discretion. One localist explained, "All we are saying is keep the police as close as possible to the people. We want to visit them in their dens." Well, the Bluecoats now used the political voice Al Yodo had granted them to join the Haight-Ashbury protests. The POA understood that Al Yodo's plan would infringe on their workplace interests by taking away dozens of prized district station desk jobs. The Bluecoats thus joined the Haight-Ashbury liberals in celebrating cooperative discretion. The POA's president said, "By closing the station, the police commission is attempting to destroy contacts and dialogue between cops and citizens in this community." Well, together, the Haight-Ashbury liberals and the Bluecoats successfully backed a citywide proposition to reopen the shuttered stations. Rank-and-file police cheered the policing arrangements left in the proposition's wake. Through liberals, police had gained the tax squad, political legitimacy, autonomy from City Hall, and discretion through cooperation. Well, the recent protests over police killings in the United States have refocused mainstream America's attention on questions of freedom and law enforcement. Liberals have responded with proposed reforms aimed at curbing or channeling police discretion, suggesting a reduction of military hardware, increased supervision through body cameras, and greater cooperation through community policing. San Francisco's post-war history helps us explain how we've reached the current state of affairs. Cosmopolitan liberals in San Francisco and elsewhere helped produce our modern understandings of crime. Laws no longer invoked morals. Instead, they emphasized harm. That redefinition opened new opportunities for white bohemians, gays and lesbians, and artists. However, white liberals continued to associate black culture with violence. White liberals therefore accepted black people into politics with the added expectation that black communities would use their newfound legitimacy to reduce violence in the streets. The legacies of these trends can be seen in the current racialization of crime and the modern-day emphasis on community policing in communities of color. Liberals also played a leading role in producing our modern-day police forces. It was through liberal efforts to extend democracy that police departments earned new physical and political powers and ultimately their autonomy. Urban liberals are now once again grappling with the discretion police officers maintain on the street. And as they do so, it is worth keeping in mind the last major liberal effort to reshape America's police forces. We would be wise to remember that the earlier attempts to extend freedom through police reform produced intended and unintended consequences and helped lead us to the police forces we live with today. Thank you.
Audiences that they are listening to Professor Christopher Agee speaking on the streets of San Francisco, a history of policing from the 1950s through the 72. It's now time for questions and answers. Anybody like to ask the first question? Anybody here a police officer?
There are police officers here.
You referred several times to the Hall of Justice. What is it and what's its function? I'm new to California, so I don't know.
Oh, it's just the, I'm referring to it as the headquarters, police headquarters. So it's just a way of talking about Chief Cahill and Al Nelder, who was his deputy chief at this time, sort of the...
So they're not an independent group, they're a part of the...
Yeah, they're the high brass, yeah, of the police department. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the demographics of the police department period that you're talking about and to the extent you know today and how it's changed over time?
Yeah, it's mostly, it changes over the course of this period. It's in the 1940s and 50s, it's a lot of white, working class men, mostly Catholic, although not exclusively. Mostly, without, post high school educations. By the end of the 60s, there's more college graduates coming in. There are a small number of African Americans, a small number of Asian and American and Latino officers, although San Francisco was behind in that respect through the late 60s and into the early 70s. It's only in the 1970s that you start getting real racial diversity and women in large numbers. I can't remember if I just said this, but in the late 60s, more officers are coming in with some college experience. Yeah, so that's the story.
That was a most interesting lecture, truly. That was essentially my question. But having grown up in Chicago, where from probably the late 1800s through at least 1970, the vast majority of both the police and fire departments were of Irish descent, and I was sort of curious how that was, at least before maybe 1960 or so here.
Yeah,
whether it was
yeah.
more uniform or not.
Irish and Italian, and that's having a lot to do with sort of the machine politics of the city, right? Appointments were given to the constituencies that they were trying to cultivate as voters, and so it's that's what's happening. You asked through 1960. By the 70s, that's changing. Don Scott gets appointed. He's the first non-Catholic police chief by Alioto. He follows Nelder, who follows Cahill. Yeah.
Thank you. Two questions. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the police commission mm-hmm. over the trajectory of the police department's its history? And I know it is after 1972. Can you comment on the difference in the San Francisco Police Department and the San Francisco Sheriff's Department, particularly in the 70s, and how the Sheriff's Department became diverse at a much more rapid pace under DeConquisto
yeah.
than the police department did.
Okay. Your first question was...
the role of the police commission.
Commission, right. The police commission is appointed and serves really at the pleasure of the mayor through this period. So... they're not taking They're simply following what the mayors want. There's not really much of an independent role for the commissioners through the 1960s. In the late 60s, and I write about this, Alioto brings in some commissioners who follow his vision and then are responsible for deciding. There are some disciplinary cases that come up. One in particular, the shooting of an African American man, where the police commission, following sort of Alioto's desires, removed that police officer from the police department. But there's not a great difference during this period between the mayor and the commission. Now the second question was about
difference in the diversification.
Yeah, right. So I interviewed Hengisto for this book. Yeah. So, he's, one of the things that my book talks about are there are a number of officers, not only Hengisto, others who are sort of embracing this cooperative discretion model that liberals in the Haight-Ashbury want. And Hengisto tries to affect that within the police department, first by creating the Officers for Justice, which was sort of a competitor for the POA. But he's then kicked out of, he asks for leave from the department, and he isn't given it, so he quits. And then he runs for sheriff and wins mainly with Haight-Ashbury backing. It's a, he gets like 30% of the vote, but it's split four ways. And so then in terms of what he then did in the 70s, I can't speak too much to that other than sort of what I know sort of generally. But his background is coming through his experience as a patrolman in the SFPD, and he shares that experience with other officers. He's not the only one. Yeah. And those officers later on would become instrumental in bringing community policing to San Francisco.
You mentioned how the shift went from patrolling for morals to patrolling for harm.
Right.
Was there much crime? Was there like organized crime or other things going on in the 50s that was being ignored as part of the political machine?
No, San Francisco is sort of famously unique for not having a lot of organized crime. In the 1940s, mafia, East Coast style organized crime, 40s and 50s. But in the late 1950s, those are a period of record lows in terms of homicide and robbery, which are sort of often used as the popular indicators for violent crime. Those numbers then start going up a lot in the 1960s, and by the late 60s, early 70s, you're seeing record highs. So this story kind of progresses with that. And it's a different kind of violence, too. It's much younger violence, and it's occurring. A lot of it is occurring in Hunters Point, where Youth for Service was working, and the riot was occurring.
Yeah. One of the things we've talked about in other events and so on is the idea that you can tell the level of a civilization by what people are complaining about. People will always complain about something, so if they're just complaining about morals and so forth, often it's that there's not so much violence or other threatening things going on.
Yeah.
So I was sort of curious.
Well, I would only say, though, that some of the quotes that I was reading about the African-American danger are mostly coming from the late 1950s, so the period of record lows.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Chris John Mitterman. There was a question or a comment about organized crime. The story in San Francisco, as it was related to me by numerous officers, my father in particular, was that with some pride, my dad told me that the cops were always tipped off from other departments as to when the organized crime guys might be making an excursion out here to perhaps look at the lay of the land and maybe get set up. The cops would have this information, and they would wait down at the train station, 3rd and Townsend, and they would meet, as they referred to them, as the Goombas from Chicago or New York or wherever they came. They would meet them when they got here, and they would give them a very rough greeting, hold them in custody, and put them on the next train out of town. So there was never a foothold here of traditional organized crime, and I think as you related with the different things that you found, the real organized crime here actually were the police. The police had control of the town, and with the apparatus that they had set up, they pretty much, in my view, were kind of acting in different roles, and one of the roles kind of was a like a pseudo organized crime outfit, but really not saying they were that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah. So I mean that's I've heard similar stories about about the train station, or later on stories about
right.
SFO.
Yeah.
Cahill, becomes nationally famous for associating himself with those efforts.
Yeah, and the finish of the incident that you refer to, where I walked into the cable car village,
right.
Was illuminating. And in that particular situation, the patrol sergeant who controlled that district had told me, it was on a midnight shift, he told me, he says, hey, meet me at 3 o'clock in the morning at the Tahitian Hut, which is in front of the Tahitian Hut, which is Bar and Geary. So I met him there, and I thought it in my interest to point out that I had observed this violation, which actually was a violation of the municipal police code for people of the same sex to dance with one another in a public place. So I told him, I had seen this up here at Cable Car Village, and I didn't do anything because it was so obviously there. I thought I better mention it to you, but I thought it was a homosexual hangout. And he looked a little bit flustered, and he explained it this way. He said, well, it is, but we don't do anything about that, because if we need to find them, we know where they are.
Right.
Okay? So that's why. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and I would say, without saying his name, you at the time told me he then is later implicated.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
The,
so he, yeah,
the gay bar corruption scandal.
That's right. He was in the middle of the gay bar, the Paola scandal, and that's where he explained it to me. So
right. Yeah. Yeah. So I write about that. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Knew where to find them when they needed money.
I know it's a little outside the scope of the book, but I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the police cameras and how discretion is kind of, how that debate is playing out in our kind of contemporary conversations about the police.
Well, I mean, it's just it's the same debate, really, right? I mean, it's what's so fascinating to me. I mean, I don't have any policy prescriptions, but what's remarkable to me is the way in which liberals haven't really figured out how they're going to approach discretion. That they were sort of still wrangling with it in the 50s and 60s and fighting over it, and now they're still not sure that, there are these methods where more supervision, more professionalization, more top-down supervision, or sort of decentralized models, more community policing, more sort of drawing up, which depend on discretion, right? That community policing doesn't work without that. So I think that's what is so striking to me, that liberal policy discussions haven't gotten further than where they were 50 years ago. They still don't know what to do about this basic element of our policing system. Yeah.
We have time for one or two more questions.
So in terms of how you've described your argument, it seems like crime is then raced as black. Is that fair to say? And then is anybody else left out of the social contract at that point?
Other groups of color.
Are there poor white people who are being policed in terms of violence? Or is this arrangement... does it work to the exclusion of African Americans or poor African Americans?
Right. Well, I mean, in terms of other groups of color, they're mostly what's sort of remarkable in the late 60s, just not being talked about. Latinos are having all sorts of contacts and growing tension with members of the police department, but that's really not part of the policy discussion. Chinatown residents... there's also tension, particularly amongst younger generation, but that's also outside the blinders of a lot of liberals who are sort of pointing to them as a model minority for African Americans to live up to. And in terms of other groups, I mean, I guess, you know, the way I'm approaching this, it's not so much, there aren't sort of dramatic changes in styles of policing on the ground. It's the terms on which people can enter politics, right? And so young whites who are maybe experiencing lots of violence in their neighborhood, representatives of their communities aren't being sort of asked to play this peacekeeping role that young African Americans are being asked to fulfill in neighborhoods like Hunter's Point. So really the difference isn't so much what's happening in policing, but the terms of acceptance in City Hall. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I know you talked about at one point there was a lot of negative kickback in regards to sending officers out in patrol cars instead of actually on the beat. And I imagine a lot of that was due to the emergence of radio technology. My only experience with that era of time is watching TV shows like Adam 12. So you have to forgive my ignorance. But what was the role that you saw technology playing in the evolution of the police force here in San Francisco?
Well, it allowed people like Al Yoda, who wanted increased sort of consolidation and increased centralization, it allowed them to sort of push that further and further, right? His ultimate plan was to eliminate all district stations, go to 4 sort of, you know, deployment stations. And you're right, that's a change over the time of this. You know, at the beginning of my period, there's no radios, there's these call boxes, which are many blocks apart. It allows people in City Hall, I think, more and more ability, if they want, to promote centralization and in their minds, taking away discretion away from officers. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Do you find that the current higher technologies or more sophisticated technologies, the cameras, also are designed to take away discretion
the idea is by making officers more accountable, right? That the officer is going to follow the letter of the policy or law that he or she's been given, right? So that is the point, right?
Right.
Of that reform,
yeah.
And then there's debate over whether it works.
Right, and that's a great way to end another event at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thanks so much. I guess books are
The books are available
somewhere.
For sale right outside. And if you have any other questions, you can come up and ask him. And thank you very much for attending. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 113th year of enlightened discussion.